Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, it's just going to be me and my friend Paul for the moment because
Harold,
Richard, I don't know, he's off doing something. He's busy tonight. Darren will be joining us in half an hour, but Lipton, as you can see, has just disappeared. So what we're just left with Lipton, an image of the room that Lipton's in. But he's left his sound off, and there is no Lipton. So he may join us. I don't know. I've no idea what's happening there. But until he does, which he may not, cheers, everybody. Cheers, Paul.
L'chaim.
Yeah. Hurligan, Gurligan, Capis, Saludo, Prost,
Scrubianan.
Scrubianan, Slanger, Slangervar, Yazagit, someone's saying. I don't know what that means. Fortification saying Yazagit.
Yakidar.
Yakidar, yes. And Tervis Sexy. Salute. What was the thing in Romanian? I think it was something like salute. Or something like that. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're, of course, on my public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, although the clocks probably haven't changed there yet, have they? So it probably isn't 2 p.m. New York. It's probably 3 p.m. New York. Ah, it's just gone. There we go. So cheers, everybody, and welcome. Your audio sounds terrible, actually. Well, piss off, then. What's the point of mentioning that? That is the most stupid thing. You know that I ban people for moaning about the audio. Everyone knows that. I banned so many people for moaning about the bloody audio. What is the point? What is the point of moaning about the audio? God's sake. Is it better now?
To be fair, you do sound a bit like a Dalek.
Now people are saying mean things like Ed has fatted. You will be. I found like a Dalek. Is it not plugged in? I mean, like they.
That's exterminate! The kind of exterminate!
Stupid system would do. Hang on. Audio, microphone array. No, that's not right. Microphone should be microphone Yeti.
Right. You've got a naturally metallic voice. I just wouldn't get too upset about it.
They've changed the microphone. No wonder things have sounded weird today. Right. Okay. How does it sound now? Audio, no, how is it? Because I just changed the audio. The audio was wrong. The input audio was wrong. Oh, for God's sake. Right, look, just forget that ever happened. I might have just start again, to be honest. That's just outrageous. It's Boomer Tech. I didn't tell the system that I'm using to change the microphone from the computer microphone from my top of the range microphone to the computer microphone. I didn't tell it to do that. A voice, don't keep saying a tiny bit better. Right, I'm leaving. That's it. I'm going. I said, Paul Hopford, I'm going out. I'm going to see what's happening with the microphone. I'm going to come back in.
Oh, God. Hello, Lipton. You're going to put your microphone on. Oh, God.
Let me unmute.
Have you heard any good jokes recently, Lipton?
No, interestingly, no, not really.
Right,
we've got Lipton to speak. That's something.
That better be better, right? I hope they held the fort. Well, I hope they said all kinds of witty things. But the problem is, chaps, I have to confess that I went. I went to Moldova, as you know, for a while, and was filming there, and was in the UK. I like the retro film. I think it's very quality audio. What? No, I just changed. God, fucking bastard.
Autism audio.
Where's Richard Grannan?
He's with a lady tonight, Lipton.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's making the beast with two backs. Can't hear you at all, Ed.
Yes, you can hear me. I hadn't switched the microphone on. Okay, right, that's it. I'm banning 6NSEVs, whoever he is. Anyone that comments on my microphone is banned. I'm not joking. This is ridiculous. Now he really is ridiculous. I've just changed the microphone so that it's not the computer's microphone, which anyway shouldn't be tinny, because why should it be? It's built into the computer. But I'm using the Yeti blue microphone, and that's that. Right, now, where was I? Yes, hello, so cheers,
chaps. That was a seamless introduction, Ed.
Yeah, it was. I think it went extremely well. So cheers, chaps, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We're, of course, on my public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. We'll discuss base science and base research and increasing times from our woke joke universities. And Hurligan, Gurligan, Capis, Saludo, Slanger, Slangevar, and things like that. And hello, everybody. Right. Now, I'll start with, because Paul is joining us in about half an hour, so where we'll talk about Aaron. What was... sorry?
You said Paul is joining us in a half an hour.
You're not Paul, you're Adams.
And then
Paul is here. I'm leaning into, I've been accused of looking like Harold Shipman and Jerry Adams. I've hybridized. I'm owning it. Yeah, you see.
And that's very good. That's very good. No, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. So what I was going to, what I was going to talk about to, or was obviously Prince Andrew, but I'll wait till Darren comes in for that. So I don't know if you've heard. Oh, by the way, I've said I've got the contagion. When I told Paul, he laughed. I didn't get any sympathy
That's not fair. I did say I think you've got it's the advanced complications of tertiary syphilis.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I don't think it's tertiary syphilis. I don't think tertiary syphilis is hitting yet. I think it is the coof, and in particular, my ears are blocked up. And there's nothing I can do about it.
Ed, I am a doctor. It is syphilitic sinusitis.
You're a doctor of sociology or something like that, and I'm not accepting your diagnosis any more than you should accept mine as doctor of divinity.
You're an expert on Friedrich Nietzsche, so you would know.
Oh, all right. Okay, yeah, surely. Yeah, you'd have to. Yeah, oh, syphilis. Yes, you're right. No. Well, haven't they doubted that it was syphilis?
That's a myth. He had a, they think it was a benign, well, not a benign, but it was a brain tumour that grew. But it definitely wasn't, because it lasted 15 years since his first symptoms. Yeah. But and even you haven't had syphilis for 15 years.
But Paul, people are still saying that he had syphilis.
It's rubbish, because syphilis kills you in 7 or 8 years, so Ed's only got a year left. But basically, he had whatever he had for 15 years.
Yeah, and he so when he first hit, like, that's really loud now. Oh, Jesus.
But isn't it, Ed, aren't you feeling slightly better? Because at the moment, you can't hear the voices in your head.
Well, I can, I know, but that's really loud in one ear, and there's nothing in the other ear. But.
So you've got a mono poltergeist in your head.
I think that the drinkers at the Jolly Heretic Public House would appreciate something real, something true, something honest. And I'm giving them that by turning up seriously ill on the stream. Ed looks like he has Tourette's. How can you look like you have Tourette's? Right, no, just pick up on that. Ben 58757. How?
No, your facial.
No.
Remarks. It's because of your facial remarks.
Is that it? Is it a facial tick thing? Is that what it is?
Because people with
Tourette's syndrome, they tend to have a strange face when they're cursing.
Right. Someone's saying buy another mic, so he gets banned. Put user in timeout. Okay. That's just how it's going to be. Like, I'm not doing this anymore. Okay. I've changed the mic to the usual mic that I use. And that's it. So I don't understand whoever said that. I don't understand how you can look like you have Tourette's.
It's facial ticks.
Is Tourette's based around facial ticks?
Well, you can have facial ticks like you have, yeah.
Like, what kind of facial ticks do I have? No, I don't. No, I don't do that. That's your...
When you get angry, you do.
No, I don't.
And you're angry a lot of the time.
No, I'm not. I'm only angry on this show. I become angry once a week, every week.
And that's when these people don't see you in your everyday life, do they? They only see you when you're angry with facial
tics. Don't see me, mate. You don't see, but you only see me when I'm with you. And
Ed,
we're
going back to the UK, Ed. We're going to University of Liverpool to talk about reparations, the four of us.
Are we? Good. Oh, by the way, Lipton, I saw a TV thing last night called The Ghost or Ghost. And Whoopi Goldberg was in it. And she was young. And she didn't look that bad. What disturbed my... Oh, God. It keeps coming and going. Like, it's ridiculous. How a chap is supposed to concentrate? Your cloths are creating electromagnetic field disturbing your audio. Like, my cloths. What are you talking about, cloths?
Well, I found out, Ed, I found out something really interesting this week. Did you know that in Dubai, they never show the Flintstones?
I didn't know.
No.
Really?
No.
But Abu Dhabi do.
Yeah,
that's something to say.
Yeah.
Somebody stole Paul's glory. That lady, Sarah Putin, she was complaining about
Oh, yeah, but adverts.
Advertisements. Black Pride's always talking about that.
All right, well, let's talk about that for a bit then until we start the main topic. So, I mean, the reaction to that, I've done a video on it, but the reaction to that is amazing. They basically take some of the comments she made, i.e. there's too many blacks and Asians on telly, and add a full stop to it, removing a comma, after which she says, and hardly any whites. So they can say, oh, she's terribly racist. She literally doesn't like seeing people of a different race on TV, but failing to add that it's the proportion of people of different races on TV that is annoying her. So it's the ultimate example of strawmanning her. And I just thought it was extraordinary and appalling. And also the idea as well that they've been going on for years and years and years, saying people like Lenny Henry, saying there needs to be more ethnic minorities on TV, more and more, more and more, more and more. It's never enough, more and more. And then when people start noticing this and start complaining about it, then they say, oh, it doesn't matter what colour people are. Oh, advertising is about selling things. It's not about being representative.
But Ed, why are you upset? Blacks have a comparative advantage in entertainment. That's what they do best.
Yeah, but I suppose
then it doesn't take a lot of acting skill to star in an advert.
No. I think there's some truth in that. It doesn't. You can see how if they're particularly good at acting and so on, then they might be overrepresented. But they're overrepresented by a significant factor. If you consider that they're 4% of the population and they're in 50% of commercials, that's a factor of 10. So that more than 10. It's a lot. It's a lot of numbers. A high number. So we can't, you know, that's that, and then when people notice this and it's in a negative way, then suddenly, oh, it's either not happening, it's not true, which we know that it is true, or suddenly colour doesn't matter when they've been going on and on about how much it matters for years and years and years and years and years. So I think it's just an example of them losing control of a narrative and thus feeling fearful. And it's really,
someone's
really
pointed out in the comments there are too many Scousers on this channel. So if you include. That's a bit ignorant, actually, because Richard is a woolly bear.
Yeah. and I'm only like one quarter Scout. If you consider that my grandfather was born in Everton, and to the extent that Scousness is a genetic trait.
Lipton, you have a job, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, if you have a job, you can't claim Scousehood.
Yeah, yeah, he's not Scout. He's not Scout. He's had a job at some point.
Yeah.
So he's not Scout, but no, one thing I did notice actually when when I found a load of commercials to watch, a load of commercials to watch is not only is our ethnic minorities significantly overrepresented in, like, basically almost all commercials and almost all adverts for TV programs, but it's also regional accents. No one's talking about that either. Regional accents, and very specifically, Geordie. Now, what I was watching, as far as I'm aware, was standard ITV stuff. But yet the voiceover people and the whatever, Geordie. And when I was a kid, people had nice posh accents that were clear that you could understand. But now,
well, I was always in favour of more working class accents on telly until Angela Rayner cured me of that.
So that's the first thing that's been going on. The second thing, though, that I wanted to look at was how on earth, and I'll start with Paul, we have a case of this chap from Ethiopia who was in the Bell Hotel in Epping, and he was found guilty of, or he was inside for the sexual assault of a 14-year-old girl. He was taken, Hadush Kabatu, he was taken to prison in Chelmsford in Essex, and somehow he has been accidentally released. And it turns out that over 800 people were accidentally released in the 3 months between January and March 2025. Now, I cannot understand how people can be accidentally released. Maybe someone has to have more of an imagination than I do. But even if it was just a filing system with cabinets, and you would cross-reference different files to different cabinets, I cannot see how someone can be accidentally released. Paul, how can someone be accidentally released?
Well, it was worse than that, because he actually tried to go back in several times. And because he didn't know what to do, and he didn't, you know, even he, you almost I emphasize, feel sorry for him, because he's obviously disorientated, doesn't know what he's doing, and wasn't running away. He went back a couple of times to ask them to look after him. So it's, I would put it down to pathological incompetence at a level that is, the blob in Britain has been incompetent for quite a few decades now. But I think we're entering a hyper phase of incompetence that's never really been seen before. And it's fascinating. It's like watching a car crash in governmental departments. And part of me welcomes it, because things can only get better. They have to get worse first. And there are so many aspects of the UK government that is failing in its most basic function. We've said this, it's a bit boring week in, week out. Yes. The borders aren't safe, the police aren't doing their job, the law courts, the judiciary keep screwing up. I slagged off the NHS, and someone from Norway, I think, seemingly misunderstood me, because apparently the NHS is full of wonderful people, but again, run by incompetent managers, so it doesn't matter how many lovely nurses you have. The NHS is a sinkhole of money and incompetence. So it's a challenge to you, Ed. Name me an area of British society that isn't falling apart.
Fortunately, I'm fortunate enough not to live there. So I.
Well, you're looking from the outside. You should have quite a decent perspective.
No, that's true. It's just so many little things. And if you, what was that theory that if you allow one window to be broken,
the broken window in New York, the broken window theory.
Right, and so this is what, through laziness, through sort of lily-livered attitudes towards crime, toward not punishing people, that sort of thing, is what we have allowed to happen.
So well, I'll say one more thing. It's what Lipton had also backed me up the other week. I keep saying it till I'm blue in the face. Lack of consequences. No one gets sacked for being incompetent. And if there are no consequences, how is it ever going to improve?
No, I've read a trade unionist was saying, oh, it's appalling the way that a particular member of ours has been suspended, and it wasn't wholly his fault, and you know, it's unfair that this person is being scapegoated or whatever. Somebody at the bottom line, somebody signed this off. This prisoner is a nationally famous prisoner.
Cultural enrichment.
Yeah, he's said on Lipton, but he's one of the, he's a nationally famous prisoner. His name must be widely known around the prison, and everyone knows what he looks like. Everyone knows who this guy is. Everyone knows why he's there. All the other prisoners know why he's there. So, of all the prisoners, this to happen to, this one, the one where it could be the most embarrassing possible for the prison, for the government, for society. That's the prisoner they release.
And some people, do you think you could get him on the show?
Probably.
That'd be a really interesting interview.
It would, wouldn't it? Although apparently we'd need a Hausa interpreter or something. A Humbrick interpreter. Apparently his English isn't very good. But even so, it makes you think it's deliberate. So a number of people in the chat have been saying this. It makes you think that one of the things they've done is they've tried to get as many foreigners, whatever, to work in the prison service, to work in the police, to work in whatever element of society it is as possible. And you can see how there could be somebody who knew who he was and released him for that reason. To cause a fuss or and not thinking in the moment, not realizing he'd be caught, not realizing he'd be blamed, not realizing the full consequences for him. I can see how that might be the case. And I wonder if that's the case with the 262 other people that were released accidentally wrong between January and March 2025, because it does seem amazing how anyone can be so stupid. It's amazing. But as you were saying about looking at it from the outside, it's not even London now. I was in some place called Polegate in Sussex the other day, and near the railway station, near the precincts of shops, there's people just sleeping in the street. And it's almost every town you go to. You can go to a really nice little town, like somewhere in Lincolnshire or something, and you just get some bloke somewhere sleeping in the street. So that's the seems to be everywhere in London. You get it, people sleeping in the street. That should, I was in Wimbledon, and there was this guy by the station, completely drunk, unconscious, lying on the floor. And there they had two, you know, these non-jobs the council now give out, you know, whatever, community protection officers or something. And they were actually dealing with it and removing him, taking him away. So it seems that in some boroughs, they have a no-tolerance attitude to this sort of thing. And you don't get people sleeping in the street. And it doesn't escalate. But the moment you get a tolerance of that, of people illegally setting up camp with these new tents that you don't need to pitch, you know, that's the worst thing. These tents, you don't need to pitch anymore. So you can so easily just sleep in the street. Then that's the start. So that's that. Every little thing you see, but it's the sleeping in the street. And you don't get that here in Finland. You just don't get it at all. Because you'd freeze to death, for a start.
Do you know why we are witnessing the decline of England? It's quite simple. We're no longer a bourgeois society. Nothing is wrong with being elite. Nothing is wrong with having standards. People used to admire the British. Do you know why? Because the British had standards. When I was in Jamaica, I would meet elderly people who would say to me, when we were a colony, the country was so disciplined. The British once had standards. But then Lee Kuan Yew told them what happened. Do you remember that video of Lee Kuan Yew cursing the British, saying that the British are no longer great again?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they have lost their standards.
Well, like even you can see that though, if you look at the commercials in the 80s and the commercials now. And the commercials in the 80s have a standard to which we aspire, which is the English upper middle class received pronunciation accent. And that's the accent that's on most TV commercials as the voiceover. And then maybe they have some kind of local accent as a character in the commercial or something like
sorry
that.
Sorry to interject, but I've been doing a video I'm working on at the moment, partially looks at 1970s Cadbury's flake adverts, just to give you that little mental image.
Yes. Now that, of course, that was Cadbury's caramel you were talking about.
That was the rabbit.
Yeah, the rabbit was Cadbury's caramel.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, and there was also, as part of my research, inverted commas, I spent quite a long time looking at the Cadbury's flake advert.
That was a posh woman, wasn't it? Cadbury's flake
there were advert. Several. There were several women.
Having a shower.
Well, my favourite's in a little punt, and she's going in a lagoon, and she fillets the chocolate, and then, as you do, has to go through a waterfall.
She did do, didn't she? And then rivulets of water streamed down her brunette hair.
Yeah, you've lost half your listeners now. They're going to be away for 10 minutes.
They were very suggestive, but that's true. but it was. Someone saying it's the best decade. Yeah, 70s, 80s, possibly, because there was still this kind of standard to which she aspired, the kind of hyacinth bouquet, over the top standard. And then there was an awareness that there was a basically relatively united society. They tried to paper over the cracks of social class differences. And you see that in things like the idea there was never any ideology in commercials is that or in TV programs is obviously rubbish. But it was, I think it was more subtle. I mean, if you look at something like Trumpton, remember Trumpton, Paul?
Windy right. Miller.
But no, that's not Trumpton.
That's Camberwick Green.
That's Camberwick Green. Trumpton is easier to deal with. But so with Trumpton, you've got this town and there's clearly different social classes and different levels of education. There's up from the mayor and the guy that's in charge of the fire brigade, who's quite posh, Captain Flack, all the way down to the woman that sells flowers by the statue of Queen Victoria. This is a social class society. But they all get on with each other. They all get on. This is the propaganda. This is, in any society that's just if it's a purely white society, then you have to have the propaganda of all the different social classes getting along. I mean, if you see that, remember that commercial from the 80s about if you see Sid, tell him.
Yeah.
And you have every possible social class. Oh, if you see Sid, do tell him. Oh, do tell Sid. And then you go, oh, do tell Sidney. There's someone like that. And so it's kind of being honest enough to say, yes, we have posh people with loads of money in the UK, but it's slightly making fun of them in order to present this superficially united England of people that should all go and buy shares in Was it British Gas or the telephone
and
company?
People were more resilient because part of my research threw up. You remember Pipkins?
No.
Oh, it was that there was a Hartley the Hare was this. If they showed it to children today, they'd trigger them. It was the ugliest puppet, I would argue, in TV history. And there was a pig, and it was quite racist because the pig didn't have a name. It was just called Pig. And he had a he had a Brummy accent, and his catch line was, "I love cream buns, Hartley," in a Brummy accent.
Right, and how did that relate to the to propagandizing?
Well, it was quite...
Oh, yeah, Pipkins, I do remember. God, yeah.
Wasn't that an ugly hare?
That was pretty ugly. That was a very ugly hare. Yeah, early 70s. Yeah, they used to repeat it when I was a kid. Yeah. But sorry, how is that papering over the cracks?
Well, I read that as an example of multiculturalism and different classes all working together in the guise of eating a lot of cream pies.
I have some good news. If you're going to work in England as a skilled worker, you will do an English test. So that's a new rule. I don't remember the details, but you're going to have to do an English test, which is good.
If they do it retrospectively, there's going to be a lot of university students failing.
Yeah, Lipton, a lot of universities. I mean, if you listen to how young people in the UK speak at the moment, it's meaningless.
Like,
it's totally meaningless how they speak. They haven't been taught to speak properly.
It's ebonics.
It is ebonic. Yeah, is that like being like barbaric? But yeah, it's outrageous. It's totally ebonic. It's ebonical. That they can't articulate proper sentences. They use these filler words such as like. They even use swear words as a filler word. I've heard them do that. So it's so I'm fucking. What are you talking about? And he was like fucking. Oh, I don't know what fucking talk about.
is right. We're becoming an increasingly illiterate society.
Oh, what's this? Oh, why do people send me messages? Sorry. I'm terribly sorry. Yes, we are. We are becoming an increasingly illiterate society, spelling mistakes everywhere, lack of proper punctuation.
Don't you think it's highly ironic that we've never had so many people who can't spell when there are automatic spell checkers? And theoretically, it should be almost impossible to send a misspelled email.
It should, in theory, yes. But there's still some words I'm sorry, like the word competent. You think it might be competent? It might not be.
That's quite ironic, isn't it?
Nope.
You can't competently spell competent.
I don't see that it's ironic.
Well, it's ironic given the meaning of the word, and you're incapable of fulfilling the meaning of the word you're trying to spell.
No, I don't understand that. But anyway, the point is that
maybe someone in the comments can explain it better than I can.
I don't think they can, right? Because it's not ironic that it can be difficult to spell the word.
Oh, let me tell you what happened recently. It's not that funny. So Paul asked me if I had a joke. Well, this is somewhat of a joke. I have this friend who likes to post some of my articles on Reddit Jamaica. So I decided to post some of them on Reddit Jamaica, and I posted the article saying that Jamaica should not become a republic, and the people said TLDR, too long, didn't read.
Yes, well, that is a problem I do get sometimes. Some correspondents of mine, who they don't know me, and they send me an email, and their opening gambit is an essay. Like that's their email. And I'm not gonna, that's ridiculous to expect me. I don't know you, you could be an idiot. So I'm not going to waste my time plowing through it to persuade me you're not an idiot quickly in a few paragraphs, and then send me a long essay later.
Well, that's protocol for an email, but for an article or a blog post, TLDR, that just means you're dumb. Like, I don't like long emails, but if you're reading an article, you shouldn't have a problem reading an article that's around 1,000 words, 700, or even 2,000. It all depends on your time. TLDR is just stupid.
What's really stupid is LMAO, as I've said many times, because it's a lie. You cannot laugh your ass off. It's insane. So
you could laugh yourself incontinent.
Yeah, well then say that then. LMI. Laughed myself incontinent. Put that. Or laughed so much that I shat. Or like whatever that is. Okay, you can put that. If it's true. If it's true. And it could be. Certainly with women, it could be possible that they laughed so much that they urinated, because that can happen with girls, can't it? So,
well, all they have to do is sneeze.
Yeah. So you just put sneeze.
I made someone, believe it or not, I made someone have to stop the car. Their husband was driving. She got out the car and had to be sick because she was laughing so much. I was saying something quite nasty and evil, and she thought this was hilarious.
And she had to vomit.
Yeah, she actually vomited, which is one of my proudest moments. And I was in the car cheering.
That is brilliant. I know a chap that's had three fiancés, and I've made two of them cry.
okay then. But so why didn't you sleep with his fiancés?
No, I didn't sleep with them. I just made inappropriate remarks. and
Lipton, why do you assume that if Ed slept with them, they'd cry?
Just believe so.
No, I suspect something made you think that.
He's heard the rumours for the way I do it.
The claw hammer?
Yes. Yes, I do it in much the same way as a well-known prime minister did Virginia Giuffre. apparently made her cry. I was going to. I know we're still waiting for Darren to come on, but let's get on to that though, because that was the topic of today's discussion. So one of the things, if you managed to have a look at it, I did send it to you, Lipton, on WhatsApp.
Yeah, Ocean. I saw the information.
Right. Now, one of the things that I find extraordinary about this is that the psychology of these women that have had bad things happen to them and whatever. It makes them into fantasists, and they lie and they learn to lie and they descend into fantasy to cope and feel special and stuff like this. And then exactly those kinds of women will expose themselves to dangerous situations in which yet more bad things will happen to them. But yet they will lie and exaggerate. And so then eventually it gets to a point where they could be telling the truth about all kinds of stuff, but we can't know because they just have a tendency to lie. And that was what I thought when, for example, she said in this book that she had a bath with Prince Andrew, and they had a bath together before sex. And I thought, well, we've got photographs of that bath. That bath is a real bath that actually exists, not just in your mind. Mm-hmm. And Prince Andrew is a big fat bastard. And even if he wasn't, that bath is a small bath. And there's no way you could really fit two people in that bath and they could realistically have a bath. So you're exaggerating. And there were lots and lots of things so far like that. Like, oh, her mum sent her, and this is in the early 2000s or something, to a special school for naughty children in which they were all like abused. And it was like this hellhole, and that they weren't allowed to have mirrors and they'd be physically and mentally abused all the time. And I thought, really? This late in time, not in the 70s on the Channel Islands, like in the early 2000s in woman-run, hyper-conscientious, hyper-child-focused society. Really, is that likely? Or that when she used to wet the bed, her mother beat her with the twigs from a rose bush so that every stroke drew blood. Really? It sounds a bit much. And there's just so many things like that, which make me think that she's probably lying.
I don't know, but sexual harassment is a serious issue. But whenever women make these allegations, if I am not compelled to follow the story, I don't. I just find some of these stories to be incredulous.
Yeah, that was pretty much my view.
I don't like this Virginia girl. I didn't follow her when she was alive. I didn't follow her any at all.
Right, so it's quite conceivable that basically Prince Andrew is a thoroughly filthy fellow. And if you read his book, this biography of his entitled, I have every reason to believe he's a thoroughly filthy fellow.
Well, Ed, can I throw some in defense of Virginia? Because it's a shame Richard isn't here to offer his professional opinion. And maybe Darren will chip in later. But I do think that traumatized people tend to misremember. And it's almost, if you've been traumatized, to give a completely accurate story of what happened to you is actually more suspicious, because the traumatized mind doesn't remember things accurately.
Paul, you're right. Trauma memory isn't real. Recovered memories are not real.
Well, no, there's two different things. Recovered memories are alleged memories that a therapist will dredge up. Traumatic memories are memories of the real actual trauma. And my point is that if you've been in a car accident and you try and relate exactly what happened, a truly traumatized person would find it difficult by definition, because you're traumatized.
Yes, but then what if that person says other things that do not relate to being traumatized, that don't relate to a trauma, but just turn out to be rubbish?
Well, then you've got the whole, I only skim read it because it was awful, but it was pretty obviously ghost written, wasn't it?
Yes, which I would like to emphasize, I regard as a lie. Why didn't they just write, this is a biography, a one-to-one telling to whatever that woman's name was, Helen something. Why do they have to try and make out that she's written it? I've never understood that either. I find that very dishonest. If I want to read someone's memoir, I want them to have written it. If I want to read the memoir of Paul Taylor, I want Paul Taylor to have written it. I don't want him to have paid some ghostwriter to write it for him. And then put in lots of unlikely allusions as well, like that make out she's really educated. They did that with Prince Harry. I don't think Prince Harry has read that much Shakespeare. All right, something tells me he may have many qualities, at least before he met that witch. He was fun. He was a good laugh, right? You know, he had all kinds of good things about him. But then, I'm being well read is not like reading Shakespeare plays and going to see them for a laugh. It's not one of the things that I think of when I think of Prince Harry. In his book Spare, there's all these allusions to Shakespeare and whatever else. You know,
more prosaically, Ed, there's a scene in the book. Hiya, Darren.
Hello, Darren.
Ah, that sounds on now. I can hear you. Hello, everybody. Sorry.
Hello, everyone. Darren is here.
If I can just finish that thought, Ed. There was a scene in the book where she's being abused and her father comes to pick her up from the police station. And his first words were effing slut or something. And it just did not ring true. It was written for effect, which is why it's my criticism of a ghostwriter. You then ask how much of the book is completely distorted by that ghostwriter.
Yeah, or just, I mean, presumably the ghostwriter has faithfully retold, but in more articulate words, what this girl has told her.
I'm sorry, the way I said it probably could sound realistic, but the way it's written, and I think there is a quote from the father where he denies most of the accusations against him. But it's just not the type of thing. The way it's written, it does not come across as realistic, or something's off about it.
Question. These Jeffrey Epstein girls, including Virginia, what happened to their parents? Where were their parents? That's the million-dollar question.
Well, I get the impression from the book that these are women from what America would call the wrong side of the tracks. And they were quite deliberately chosen for that reason, because they can be manipulated and black and they need the money, and so they're easier to manipulate. And if Virginia Roberts has anything to go by, then her background is just so dysfunctional. Although her parents are still together, though. They're not broken up, at least not at the point when she's involved with Prince Andrew. They're so dysfunctional. They come across implicitly as, you know, just a dysfunctional lower-class family, and just don't seem to really care what their kids do and just let them do what they want. That's the impression I get. But then she says all these nice things about, oh, Mum, and I'd better take a photo for Mum of me with Prince Andrew, because Mum would like that. And little things like that made me think, well, you must be close to your mum to some extent. I found it so confusing.
Did you ever provide us an evolutionary account of the Jeffrey Epstein case? Because we do know that trauma can affect people, but traumatized people are usually from traumatized family, and it's also genetic. Dysfunctional men date dysfunctional women, and their children were dysfunctional. So to a great extent, trauma is driven by your genes and your life history.
Yeah, well, that's the impression I get. The impression I get is that she has parents who are congenitally messed up. If she's telling the truth, who can tell? That the father sexually abuses her, the mother severely beats her, this sort of thing. And so you've got a background like that, and then this is going to push you towards being a fast life history strategist, mentally unstable, whatever, just inherited. And then the background makes it worse, and then she's exposed to this dangerous situation, and she's exposed to the possibility of money and meeting rich people, and then she just goes for it. But anyway, Darren is here. And
can speak.
So, Darren, we're talking about the Virginia Roberts Giffray book, Nobody's Girl, and we were thinking about how there's lots of things in it that don't seem to make any sense and imply that she's kind of a liar. That's basically what we're saying.
I only got it this afternoon. You sent it to me. I haven't had an opportunity to read it, so I can't really comment on what's in the book. So I haven't had an opportunity to read the whole thing yet. So,
Darren, you don't get this channel, do you?
No.
It's never stopped dead commenting on books he's never read.
No, never. Well, you've surely heard about it on the telly. I mean, to be fair, you've
on this channel, it's a distinct advantage not to have read the book you're talking about.
I got the book just before I sent it to you, so I had a few seconds ahead of you, and I have actually read it. Well, not all of it, but I've read some of it. But it's there's just lots of little things in it that I was thinking that the kind of women who these things happen to, often presumably they've been traumatized in some little way, I guess, I don't know, and they is lying and fantasy a response to that, and then ironically they might be telling the truth, at least about some of the things that have happened to them, but they're so prone to fantasy and lying as a consequence of those things happening to them that we can't believe anything they say.
To pick up on something that was just being said just as I came in, you mentioned about wanting to take a picture of Prince Andrew for Mum. Remember, this is a young girl. This is someone who, if the parents are emotionally distant, emotionally vacant, if love and approval and things like that are very conditional, even if they're being mistreated, even if they're being ignored, the child is still going to want to try to do something, to try to achieve something, try to have something, to try to gain some kind of love. So there could be something in that, trying to get a picture of Prince Andrew, trying to get Mum's ever elusive approval. So there could be something in that. There could be truth in that.
Yes, but what about that we have clear evidence that she lies. Like there are things that, like, for example, saying she had a bath with Prince Andrew, an impossibly small bath. So we know that she lies, and there have been problems like that again and again, which, of course, then undermine her credibility with regard to everything she says.
Ed, do you think you might just be agoraphobic in a bath sense?
No,
you
no,
have unrealistic expectations of bath dimensions.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. I think realistically, I expect to be able to lie out my entire body in the bath.
Sorry, Ed, I just lost you all there for about 10 seconds or so. I don't know what
it means. It was crucial information, Darren.
Sorry about that. I don't know if I froze or something, but you three just went blank.
How big is your bath, Paul?
It's big enough to fit me, therefore bloody big.
Right. So I think that's a reasonable sized bath. But anyway, what I was saying, Darren, was lying and fantasy and exaggerating and things like that, can that be a response to trauma and a traumatic childhood and things?
There are. It could be like a form of dissociation. Whenever we dissociate, there's different ways we can do that. But it is a defense mechanism. Sometimes we will emotionally numb ourselves. Sometimes it's like we zone out. Sometimes it's like we're watching it. It's like we're watching it on television. We're watching it from a distance. We're not in it. There are different ways we can dissociate. It is possible that what she could have been doing was dissociating. So we do tend to remember things, and we will remember certain things. We'll remember key things. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're lying, but sometimes we will remember things in specific ways, maybe how that impacted us, that sort of thing.
Right. So it's a separate issue then. If you say the fact that a female just is a mythomaniac, just goes around lying, can't stop herself from lying, is likely to be independent of any abuse she may have experienced when she's young.
I think he's frozen again.
Sorry. Yeah. Do you know what it is? We're having bad weather at the moment. There could be something affecting my wife. I am not sure. Sorry about this, chap.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yeah.
What I'm saying is, if a woman is a mythomaniac, if she goes around just compulsively lying and exaggerating and things like that and saying things that aren't true, that would be independent of any abuse she may have experienced. It wouldn't be partially caused by the abuse.
It is possible, yeah, I guess so. But sometimes right. It's just... Sorry, go ahead.
No, because that's what I was wondering about with her. If you have this terrible irony whereby the fact that she's been abused or she's got used to lying or things because her parents beat her up and then she... And then it becomes second nature and she kind of can't help herself. In that case,
it becomes like a survival strategy, a survival tactic for her. Okay.
Right. So I'm just wondering then you get this terrible situation where that same person that does things like that would also take risks and expose herself to things like this woman has done. And then she gets put in this terrible situation where some of these things might have happened.
Mm-hmm.
That it's hard to take her fully seriously because she just keeps saying things that just don't make any sense.
Well, going back to the idea of the dissociation, sometimes we will remember, there's a defense mechanism kicks in where we try to remember things. We'll try to remember it in a specific way. Now, there could have been something going on where maybe as that survival strategy, she will tell maybe mum and dad the things that she thinks they want to hear to try and get either their approval or to try to avoid their disapproval, their rejection, whatever punishments and things like that. So there could be a combination of things going on. If that's what you're asking.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, Rodian Maiden is saying, oh no, not Virginia, another so-called victim, my bad. Right, yeah. this is... it is. Darren is a therapist, Chuck McNorris. Yes. So that's what we're trying to. That's what we're trying to establish. But we might move on to something else because you didn't have time to read the book. But anybody, we're about halfway through. So those of you new, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. We discuss based science and research, which is recently expanded from our woke joke universities. If you are new, will you please subscribe? Will you subscribe here on YouTube? And will you subscribe to my Substack? That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based research I did on YouTube, vlogs, films I make, in-person interviews, and if you like what I do, you can support me with the cost of a pint of beer a month. And those in-person interviews include people like Darren and Paul and Lipton. And next to Paul, next to me, sorry, we have Harold Adams, he calls himself, Harold Adams, and of Harold Shipton and Jerry Adams, which are the two men he looks like and is like psychologically. That's Dr. Paul Taylor. So please subscribe to his channel. And that is Readers of the Lost Art. This takes a wry look at developments in contemporary art and that sort of thing.
Can I give a quick plug, Ed?
Yeah.
I'm working on a video that's because I'm trying to belie the reputation of my channel for being a bit miserable, as you've just pointed out. So one of my forthcoming videos is all about rabbits. And I came across the theme of you love your poetry, don't you?
Mm.
there's now my favorite upbeat poem of all time I encountered. It's Philip Larkin, and it's called Mixomatosis. So maybe you could read it out later, and that would give everyone, it'd be very, you know, uplifting for us all.
Although, look what I got at Bateman's. At Bateman's in Sussex, the complete poetic works, and it was £8 for a second-hand copy of this book in the Holmes antiquarian bookshop, and then £5 for exactly the same book new. So obviously, I went back and demanded my money back from the nice volunteer who was working in the antiquarian bookshop.
What's the name of that lady who said that Donald Trump raped her and she's not pretty? The Jean lady. What's her name again? Her last name.
The Jean lady?
Not Jean, Jean. That cartoon-looking lady who said that Donald Trump raped her.
Well, Donald Trump raped Betty Boop.
No, it's a cartoon lady. What's her name? Jean? Let me look for it.
Jessica Rabbit, yeah. that was alleged. That was alleged, yeah. And it was particularly complicated, what with her being a cartoon.
Eugene Carroll, that's her name.
I don't know. I don't look. Anyway, carry on. And then below we have Darren F. McGee, I believe, who is a therapist, and he has his channel, Darren F. McGee. So go and subscribe over there. And then finally, behind the man behind the carpet is Lipton Matthews, and he has his own channel, Lipton Matthews. So go and subscribe. Eugene Carroll, says Matt James 684.
You know, Lipton just reminded me of, it just flashed in my head. He looks like Colonel Gaddafi, who used to wear those robes.
He does a bit, although he has more Nubian blood than Colonel Gaddafi.
But his dress sense, Lipton has Gaddafi's dress sense.
Let's hope things don't end in the same
way. When are you going to give me my 18 trillion? Lenny Henry said that we should get 18 trillion for slavery.
Yeah, let's not go into that, Lipton. I want to keep this video up. We can do that in another video, and because it's gone fine so far. We're at 53 minutes. You've said nothing too controversial, and I'm very proud of you. Not in a patronizing way. I'm very proud of the fact that you haven't done that yet. We have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn. And he has presented us with the following poem. Sorry. Formerly Grand Duke of York, Prince Andrew has now had to walk. The poor late Virginia, when younger and skinnier, engaged in a lot of loose talk. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. And he also writes in that, I suppose, on Thursday, it's my birthday. So he writes, oh, blimey, I'm now 45, but now I feel really alive. My IQ's now stable. I'm fit and I'm able and helping the West to survive. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. That is very kind of you. And if you would like to, if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, then please do buy his book of Jolly Heretic Poetry, which is available on Amazon. and also he has a channel of Jolly Heretic Poetry. So you should also go over and subscribe there. God, yeah, I remember when it was my Jolly Heretic 40th birthday celebration, and I was live streaming on my own, and all these lovely people rang in from all over the place, and that was 5 years ago. That was very, very lovely. And then we have I'll read Mix. Let me find Mixomatosis. I forget. I think that was one of them, because you know, Paul, that he only published a volume of poetry roughly every 10 years, so his outcome is actually quite small. And there's loads of poems by him that were never published in volumes or were published after 1974, which was when he last published a volume. So,
no, but anyone who can listen to his poem, Mixomatosis, without laughing loudly, there's something wrong with you.
Well, let's just do it now then. So, Mixomatosis. Okay. When was this written? Let's have a look. It doesn't say. Okay. Caught in the center of a soundless field, while hot, inexplicable hours go by. What trap is this? Where were its teeth concealed? You seem to ask. I make a sharp reply. Then clean my stick. I'm glad I can't explain just in what jaws you were to superate. You may have thought things would not come right again if you could only keep quiet still and wait. That's horrible, isn't it? Yeah. And I remember seeing some book of animals when I was 8, and it had a school.
Oh, your reaction that I'm laughing at, not the poem.
And it had.
I want to ask you professional opinion, Darren, because the more I read of dark, disturbing stuff, I've just noticed as I'm getting older. I forgot to ask you, Ed. Was that Kipling?
No, it was laughing.
No, but Darren, as I get older, I think it's Camus' idea that you just find life so absurd. The darker it is, the funnier. So I'm typing up slides based upon this poem. I'm howling with laughter. But I read that James Joyce was doing Finnegan's Wake, and his wife kept coming into the kitchen saying, "What are you laughing at?" And he was saying things, "They won't understand this, the bastards," and then would write some more. So I don't think I'm that odd. There were, not that I'm claiming I'm James Joyce, but you know what I mean? I think there is this, if gallows humour taken to a rather extreme degree, I do admit. But I'm finding as I get older, I do it more and more.
It is revolting, though. When I was about 8, I'd never heard of myxomatosis till I was 8. And for some reason, there was this book about, I don't know what it was about, rabbits, I guess. Very 8 years old, so a very young children's book. And there was a photo in it of a rabbit with myxomatosis.
Oh, worse than that, Ed, because I live in an area. I had a Staffordshire Bull Terrier, Barbie the Bull Terrier, and she loved people, but she was psychotic with any other living, breathing animal of any type. And she was acting oddly in the back garden in a different house in the same area. And I worked out. I just went to where she was nosing around. There was a myxomatosis rabbit, and it was one of the most horrible things I've ever seen, because their eyes just glaze over with this horrible disease, so they can't do anything. They're just waiting to be, you know, victimized. And but it was weird because the dog knew not to go near it, and that dog would have attacked absolutely anything. But there was this, the disease was so horrible, it just gave off this, you know, something's not right here vibe. Oh, it was disgusting. And it's a completely man-made disease, isn't it?
Their eyes are just closed over. And they have a pained look on their face.
Oh, it's horrible. So luckily, a neighbor, but it's like with the stick, a neighbor came round because I was too nesh and basically broke its neck for me.
Well, you were too nesh to just stamp on its little head.
Oh, I've got, I'm a you know, relatively evil person, but insofar as I am a decent human being, it's all devoted to animals. I can't stand the thought of animal cruelty.
Yeah, my daughter, when she was quite young, got very upset about the idea of hurting a wasp. I'm sure she'd hurt humans, no problem, but a wasp.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm like. I look after the people in my basement, but I would never mistreat an animal.
No, me neither. No, me, yeah, the people in your basement are fed and sexed.
Yeah.
But they know at what time as well. They know when they see the
slightly cruel thing is it tends to be flatbreads, pizzas, anything that fits under a door. So the diet is limited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure. But there's a love there.
Yeah,
if you can call.
No, I don't believe in wanton cruelty. And there's something about the vulnerability of animals that I just think, you know.
Yeah, it does. It does. I would get when that dog got killed in Jaws. That was terrible. But when the little boy got killed, not so much.
Ed and Paul, when we're in Liverpool, what are you going to talk about?
Again, listen, I've told you, I don't want you bringing these kinds of things up on the show that I want to leave up on YouTube. So
no, I remember now.
Stop! You've just got a one-track racist mind, and you've got to just leave it. Just leave it alone. We're here to talk about Prince Andrew and Virginia Giuffre and women who are crazy and why. So I'll get back to that, Darren. One thing I was thinking is that maybe these women that were killed as witches in the 17th century were just like crazy, mental, abused fantasists who just wouldn't let go of their fantasy. And thus ended up getting hanged. What do you think about that?
It's possible. Or they could have just been hanged by the mad, crazy accusations of people that just didn't like them.
Yes, that is possible as well. But my understanding with the What's that place on the border between Yorkshire and Lancashire? Pendle.
Taint.
Pendle.
Taint.
Pendle.
Taint.
Is no Pendle. Is
wasn't
the,
a joke is, about taint?
Yeah, but that wasn't Yorkshire and Lancashire.
That was my
that was
joke.
That was Lincolnshire and Yorkshire, I think. So it's called the Grimsby.
Never make a joke to an autistic person is what I learn every week.
Try and make a joke that actually makes sense is what you should learn every and is funny, is what you should learn every week.
It's called tell you my like, Quasimodo joke then.
Yeah, well then.
Quasimodo's had a hard day on the bells and he comes home, he's absolutely starving. And Esmeralda reaches up on the kitchen cupboard and starts to bring down the wok. And he goes, oh, God, we're not having Chinese food again, are we? And she goes, bugger off, I'm ironing your shirt.
So, all right, I'll just be vague then. So, Darren, what's caught your topical news-based eye since we last spoke?
What I'm actually thinking is that, you know, the topic for tonight, talking about Virginia, whether she's telling the truth or not, whether she's telling the whole truth or not. Maybe this is just me. This is just my perspective. I would rather put time and effort into trying to help someone who's been through a lot of stuff, even claiming they've been through a lot of stuff that she claims she'd been through. I would rather do that than to turn away someone who genuinely has been abused and all the rest, but I would rather if she was coming to me looking for help and support, yeah, I'd be working with her. I think it's this thing, I know Richard, I think it might have been Mark he was talking to, he put up a video. I haven't got watching it yet, so I'm not sure the content of it, but it was looking at things like victim blaming and so on. And I think one of the things I might have said this off camera to a couple of you guys once. One of the biggest causes of trauma and distress is actually other people. It's abuse, it's malice, it's cruelty, it's callousness, all of those sorts of things. The biggest cause of trauma. I don't really have anything to back this up, but these are just my thoughts. The second biggest cause are people's reactions to it. Especially when people do nothing, or people blame the victim, or people don't believe them. I think one of the most devaluing thing you can ever say to someone, you know, you talk a lot about narcissism, Richard and I talk about it, and you've talked about it as well, Paul, on your channel. One of the most devaluing things you can say to someone who's trying to tell you their story is, well, they're not like that with me. They're always nice when they're around me. You know, things like that. We talked the last time I was on, we were talking about the power of listening. How important it is to listen to someone. You're not necessarily agreeing with them. You're not necessarily colluding with them. Or anything. You're actually giving them a bit of space. Which is why I say, even if not everything she's saying is true, I think she deserved help and support and some kind of encouragement. Something, someone to show her some kind of real human connection. And I would rather do that with someone who's maybe just, for want of a better word, they're swinging the lead, they're lying through their teeth. I would rather take the risk, take the chance, and waste time working with someone who's lying to me rather than deny help.
What if you try to help them and you say to them, look, you know, we're both adults here, and I appreciate that you've been through some less than entirely pleasant stuff, but I have concerns that you are telling fibs, you are lying, and I want to help you, and I'm pretty sure there's been something there. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to kind of do this if it's obvious to me that you're lying and you can't admit that. And then that person just goes into denial and says, oh, I tell the truth. I only tell the truth. Everything I'm saying is true.
But Ed, can I ask you a question? There's an old Chinese proverb: when a finger points at the moon, the idiot looks at the finger. And you might be doing a bit of finger gazing, given with the grooming gangs, and even in America, the human trafficking that goes across the southern borders. Do you think perhaps there's some focus on this whole Virginia story because it has the elements of celebrities and famous and powerful people, and people are fixating as some type of displacement activity on whether it's true or not, when hiding in plain sight is human trafficking and abuse on an industrial scale, and that there is this systematic unwillingness to confront that reality, even though everybody knows it's happening in quite a bizarre fashion. I'm waiting as a society for us to hit our Ceausescu moment, when finally the people in charge, you were saying nothing to see here, nothing to see here, finally they can't contain it anymore.
I agree with Paul. I think that the grooming scandal in the UK is a more serious issue. Many of the girls who have been implicated in the grooming scandal were vulnerable young women. We don't know a lot about the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. We don't know if they were just young women who were primed by their parents or irresponsible adults to do what they did. But the girls who were victimized by the Muslim grooming gangs were indeed vulnerable. And people don't seem to care as much.
These girls were vulnerable, though, to be fair. If you look at the book, these girls that he was dealing with and Epstein and so forth were...
But you accept the more, Ed, do you accept the more specific point I'm making, that people...
It's an interesting point to focus attention on abuse that's happening by upper-class people, it seems, in a kind of weird... what's that Korean TV series? Squid Game sort of way. I think that abuse may be true to some extent, but it's easier to focus on that and say, oh God, look, the evil elite, rather than to focus on something that's much closer to home for so many people.
And also that the Epstein stuff lends itself to the conspiracy mob.
Exactly.
And again, it may or may not be true, but there's nothing like a conspiracy for people to go down the rabbit hole. Whereas the things that are happening in Britain and the UK in terms of human trafficking and abuse are hiding in plain sight.
We've asked Darren two questions, and he's an expert in this area, so I'd like him to answer. So, Darren, what do you think about Paul's idea?
If I understand you right, Paul, because you did freeze for a second, so I hope I'm understanding you right. They're looking at the finger and not looking at what the finger's pointing at. Is what you're saying, it's like they're looking at who is saying something as opposed to what's being said, sort of thing. I understand.
I'm making the point that there are structural, I repeat the phrase because I think it's an important one. There's abuse on an industrial scale in both the US in terms of human trafficking and in the UK in terms of things like the grooming gangs. And I think there's a temptation because the way the media works for clickbait, the way the media works for stories, it focuses on the powerful and the celebrities. And I think it's beggars belief that even though now in the UK, for example, everybody knows about the grooming gangs, it's still within the last few weeks, the British government has stood there in Parliament and tried to block an inquiry. And it gives me a brain aneurysm trying to think of how do people accept that? It amazes me how docile the British people can be. And part of what I'm suggesting is the fixation on people like Epstein is arguably a type of displacement activity. Let's focus on that. So psychologically, we don't have to focus on the very thing we're spending all our energy on not admitting to.
It's like a psychological sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
I think Paul should be prime minister,
but not the one mentioned in Virginia Giuffre's book. Not the well-known prime minister who's a sadist. No. But the other thing, then, Darren. So, what do you do then? What do you if a person gives you reason to think they've probably been abused, but they also lie and they clearly do? How can you helps
if there is lying there could be lying for different reasons, and it could be a defense mechanism. It could be a way of trying to keep themselves safe. This is where in therapy, a huge part, I think I talked about this last time, and Carl Rogers talked about this. A huge part of the work is done in the relationship that is built between the client and the therapist. Client doesn't necessarily want someone who is an expert in something. They don't necessarily want a therapist who knows all these amazing strategies and tips and techniques. What they're looking for is a genuine human connection with someone who, where they feel there is something about feeling safe, but also someone they feel comfortable with, comfortable being able to talk about things that are deeply uncomfortable. And with a, you know, with a good therapist, there are ways to help identify and recognize our various defense mechanisms. Now, I'll give you an example. I'm sitting in therapy with my therapist. My therapist is, I love her to bed. She's absolutely amazing. She doesn't miss and hit the wall. She knows me so well. I'm talking away to her about something. And halfway through, while I'm trying to get off my chest what I'm talking about, she just interrupts me and says, Darren, can I just remind you, you're intellectualizing again. Okay. Do you know what I mean? So I have to recognize that in myself. It's the different things we do. Our defense mechanisms, they're largely unconscious. They kick in automatically.
But when something as fundamental as lying, then they will often say, oh, God, I don't lie. I only tell the truth. I'm the most truthful person ever. I never, ever lie. That there'll often be total denial about something like that, like this Virginia woman.
But again, that's making assumptions.
Well, let's assume it's not an assumption. They will often be, aren't they often in denial about that?
Well, again, denial is a defense. It can be a defense mechanism. It's probably, again, I've nothing to back this up. This is just what I think. I think denial is possibly one of the first defense mechanisms we ever learn. You think of a toddler. You go into the room and there's chocolate all over the place. It's all over them. It's all over the carpet. And you say, who made that mess? Did you make that mess? What's the first thing they say? No.
Right. So it's very, very immature defense mechanism.
Going back to something you said earlier on, Paul, about the laughing. Now, Freud, I believed that humor is one of our most mature defense mechanisms. The ability to laugh at the ridiculous side of things, to see the absurdity in things, even in ourselves. It can be very useful for diffusing tension, things like that. But it's like all our defense mechanisms, they can be adaptive, they can be healthy, but then, you know, it depends on how they're being used, I guess. They can be quite maladaptive. They get us out of a moment's discomfort, but that's all they do. They don't help us in the long term.
Yeah, but I do believe art has a cathartic aspect, and I also believe so. When Liverpool recently been losing a lot, shout at the wife, kick the dog, and before you know it, you feel good again. So there is something about getting it out of your system rather than letting it fester.
Sorry, guys, I'd lost you there again. I think it's my Wi-Fi. Sorry about that. So I missed whatever was just said. I'm sorry.
I was talking about kicking the wife and shouting at the dogs. Did I get that back to front, Ed?
No, you kick the wife and you shout at the dog, and then
because I claimed I'm never cruel to animals.
You feel better. You feel better after you know.
No, Dan, I'm making it. Sorry, I'm joking again. But to be serious, the thing about catharsis, I think art has this cathartic element that I'd argue isn't. It's short term and long term. Because the ancient Greeks, their whole notion of tragedy, the tragic plays and stuff, it was like a safety valve for the whole society. And one of my ongoing arguments is that our society lacks anything of that cathartic complexity, because we have short fixes. We have Hollywood feel-good films. We have short programs. We very rarely have a program on TV or a cinematic movie that pushes us. So to give you a very specific example, I'm doing this research on everything to do with rabbits, and I looked at Watership Down, and the beginning quote of Watership Down is an epigraph from Aeschylus's Agamemnon. and about the smell of death. It smells like the death of the tomb is the one of the opening quotes. And this is a children's book. And the whole book is, it's deeply, reading it as an adult just to do this research, it was like, my God. And I'm just curious, at the time, so I think it came out in 74. I'd love to know what the reading age, the suggested reading age was. Because I honestly, this isn't an exaggeration, I know university students who would be triggered by reading Watership Down.
Do you know from where I learned the word querulous?
I'm guessing Watership Down.
No, just William.
All right.
So that was written in the 20s and aimed at what? Kids of 9, 10? Now, I'm guessing the word querulous was more common then. It's kind of died out, as well as it being a high order word. It's kind of died out. You also find the word querulous in the book Wolf Solent, which is a novel by, Powers Cooper, aimed at adults. But it's died out. But that's that word, and they would expect a child of 10 or 9 to know it. So, of course, the reading age has gone down.
Well, there's also just a bit, and again, to be serious for a second, there's a section in Watership Down where they go to a warren of a different group of rabbits. And the rabbits welcome them and they think everything's okay, but they get a sense something's not quite right. And to cut a long story short, what they find out is everyone in that new warren, the farmer basically takes occasional rabbits, but the whole of the warren is in denial that anyone's being taken because they're comfortable and it's only one at a time. And the new rabbits are thinking this isn't psychologically normal. That everyone's in denial of this truth, to get back to this issue of denial. And it's a rule that no one is allowed to ask in that warren, where is somebody?
They're also atheists. They believe the farmer provides, and they don't believe I haven't read the novel, I got bored. But with that one, they have a very effeminate guy that's in charge. And they say LLRA and his trickery. It doesn't really mean anything to us. And they're kind of amazed by this. It's as though these people are communists or something.
But William, what he's describing though at quite a complex psychological level is the investment. If you think of that warren as an analogy for bureaucracy and the ruling elites in the UK and the US at the moment, and what they're prepared to invest in denying, it's almost the price of doing business. Given that this was a book that was written for children, and I think that's one of the things, you read Watership Down when you were 10 or 11, you absorb some bloody useful lessons for the injustices of the life that you're going to lead, a part of what it is to be an adult.
And the seagull was clearly Jamaican. Just like Lipton. Didn't he? The seagull. Remember the seagull?
It's quite far to fly from Jamaica to Berkshire.
Well, he had a Jamaican accent, or was it a French accent? I always assumed it was a Jamaican accent, and he'd fly south for the winter or something.
An albatross could fly from Jamaica to Berkshire, but not a seagull.
Well, it sounded Jamaican.
But anyway, I'd like to thank you, Ed, for picking up on the most important aspect of what I was talking about.
Big water! Water.
That's the bit you remember. I don't remember much about Watership Down. I didn't read the book, but I remember being very young and my parents got it on video. There's an animation. If you remember, there's an animation, a movie of it. And my parents got it out in video. My brother and I sat and watched it. I remember we were heartbroken. This is not what we were expecting. And there's a character in it, if I remember. There's this rabbit, a really big rabbit. He had one eye, called the General, and he was terrifying. He's a rabbit, and he's terrifying. He is really, really scary.
General Woundworth.
That's the name, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Right. That's my memory of Watership Down. Very disturbing for maybe, 8 or 9 or something like that?
Yeah, but this is what I'm suggesting is that at the age of 8, and I'm guessing Watership Down would probably have been targeted anywhere from 8 to about 13. It was that level of reading. That level of reading, you're now talking about 18 to 20-year-olds would probably be at that level of reading. That's how far we've regressed. But the psychological darkness that people aren't exposed to, and then you wonder why there's a whole generation of snowflakes.
Yes, exactly. And they should be made to watch Watership Down. Any of them that cry should be beaten.
I don't want to be beaten. I cried.
And the well, can I just make one other thing? What's interesting is the original film is the thing the film was made, was it 78? The original animation.
Yeah, the animation, yeah.
But they've then done another, I don't know what they call it, like CGI type animation. I think a more modern version.
Mm.
And it's just there's something about CGI that isn't as evocative because your imagination doesn't have to fill in the gaps. Mm. So it just leaves everything flat feeling. So the example I always give is, do you remember Jason and the Argonauts, the old-fashioned film?
Where the stop-motion animation.
Skeletons come up and start fighting.
Yeah.
Now, as a kid, that was genuinely scary. But now the more realistic CGI-type stuff, it doesn't have the same uncanny effect.
Mm, that's right, yeah. And it's the same with, if you look at the 1930s version of King Kong, it was the same technology way back then as well, using the stop-motion animation.
Another example would be the old Nosferatu pictures, Bela Lugosi, and that, I would argue, is genuinely more scary than the more modern versions.
I think that the original version of Psycho was much scarier than the remake, what they made about 20 years ago.
I wouldn't watch the remake just on principle.
I didn't know they'd made a remake. Wow.
Yeah, it was frame for frame, exact copy.
What was the point of that?
It wasn't frame for frame. Are
you talking about American Psycho?
They focus much more
Hitchcock Psycho.
On her naked body, and they really go over the board, and so you can see like right up her ass and weird shit like that. It's not frame for frame. It's gratuitous.
I didn't watch it on principle, but I must have misremembered. I thought I'd read that it was a almost frame for frame copy.
Mm.
The other thing is, and I, again, maybe there's a place for it to try and reimagine something. The number of remakes, the number of sequels, people ran out of imagination.
And prequels.
So I saw a prequel the other day to what's that thing called, The Omen. And so this is a 70s film. And they've made a prequel, and as society collapses and becomes more decadent, you become obsessed with money. That's one of the things that happens. First, you become stupider, so you're less able to come up with original things. Secondly, you become more concerned about offending people and stuff, and individually oriented values, so you're less able to come up with original things. And thirdly, you're just more obsessed with money, and so you don't want to take a risk. Because it might fail. Look,
a great example of that would be The Living Dead, you know, the zombie series. And they must have made about 12 series, and there's a prequel, and there's a sequel, and there's an interequel, whatever. It's ridiculous. But the irony is that it's a program about zombies, this never-ending, repetitive creature that is now relived in the never-ending number of series, and on it goes.
I don't know about the rest of you, but zombies are one of those things. I know they can be creepy and they eat you and all that sort of thing, but I always imagined that the outbreak of a zombie outbreak, you know, they're all going crazy. I just imagine myself thinking, I'd best finish my cup of tea and then walk away briskly. So they just stumble around the place, you know.
Like, I saw a film the other day, and it was quite interesting, and it was about like how all but one child in a nursery school class go missing. And I thought, that's quite interesting. How are they going to resolve that? And then and it keeps being from the points of view of different people, and there's all kinds of weird shit that happens. And eventually they basically resolve it with a Deus Ex Machina. Well, I'm not going to give away the plot to you, but essentially a kind of Deus Ex Machina. And it's extremely disappointing. So when they try and do something good, it's rubbish.
One show that I find really interesting, although it's simple, is The Big Bang Theory, because the only show on TV that's just normal. There's nothing outrageous about it. No gay character. It's just really normal.
I've never seen that yet. I know a lot of people who do watch it, Lipton, and they keep telling me, watch it, I would really enjoy it. But I used to watch a lot of television, but that keeps getting recommended to me, and I've never...
Yeah, it's good until they start making it into the new Friends. So before they started, like these people, particularly Sheldon, who is the kind of genius type in it, They would not realistically have girlfriends.
Exactly.
And so it's when they decide, let's give them all girlfriends. Let's make it into the new friends. They've all got girlfriends. And suddenly it's about relationships, which is, of course, when it took off. But that's when it stopped being good. And then they realize it's successful. And so they keep it going and keep it going and keep it going and keep it going. And eventually one of the main characters, and it dies. And they still keep it going and keep it going.
Who died in the Big Bang Theory? The old man?
The mother of...
Leonard's mother. She died in the show and in real life, yes.
Yeah. Well, she died in real life because she died in the show.
So is your theory, Ed, that it stopped being good when they went into the post-incel phase?
Yes, pretty much, yeah. Well, there was the on-off thing between, I think his name's Leonard, and Penny or something.
No, Leonard got married to Penny. Howard got married to Bernadette.
Darren hasn't watched it.
Neither have I.
Yeah, lots of laughter track. No, I don't think it's did Sheldon's mum die, really, Tommy? 5023. I didn't know that.
Let me look it up. If it's in real life.
I don't care, but it's boring. It's in the past. It's not funny. There's been nothing good in terms of comedy since the IT Crowd. Nothing, just nothing. And there probably won't be ever again. And we're just not in that phase of civilization. We're not in the phase of civilization. We do new things that are good.
Oh, they're apart remaking Fawlty Towers as well, I believe.
Yeah, natural demands.
Remaking
it? What I mean,
It's
absolutely preposterous. And they did a remake of Reggie Perrin, which I didn't even watch. And it's just a
I saw one or two episodes of the Reggie Perrin thing. A very different take on it. If I remember right, it was a good few years ago. One or two episodes a scene, all you really saw was just someone who was very stressed, whereas Leonard Rossiter, he was manic. Yeah,
so. It's like, you know, the American version of The Office. I'm not saying it was awful, but what they completely failed to realize was that you can't emulate Slough in an American context. We look at, I forgot what the name of the place was, their American equivalent.
Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Scranton. And we look at that and it still looks to a British person exotic. Whereas there is nothing more depressing. There's that poem about Slough, isn't there?
Yes.
And Slough is this... I just feel this urge to keep saying Slough in a depressed tone of voice.
From the radio. It's not their fault they go and shop in Maidenhead and talk of... talk of sports and makes of cars in various bogus Tudor bars and don't look up to see the stars, but belch instead. Yes.
Yeah, you don't get that.
In saving homes with care, their wives frizz out peroxide hair and dry it in synthetic air and paint their nails. Yes, anyway, sorry, yes.
Ed? Last week, this is completely random, but last week I was super happy because Joel Moncur won the Nobel Prize.
Who's that?
He's an economist, a famous economist who writes on culture and ideas, and he won the Nobel Prize along with two other people, Philippi and Peter Howitt.
Well, good.
But don't you think, Ed, it's a sad sign of the times. It's the idea that you take something like The Office, you remake it for people who haven't got the capability to understand the sadness that was built into the humor of the first one.
Yes.
I watched The New Office with my wife and it is actually funny.
That's exactly what I'm saying. What's unique about the British Office is it's both funny and tragic.
Right, but it's what's the brilliance of the tragedy is a person that is reasonably intelligent, but he's a bit lazy. And he's a poor impulse control, I don't know, a bit of a loser, really. And he knows this job is an awful job. It's a boring job. He gets nothing out of it. And she's the same. The girl, the love interest, Dawn, the same. She wants to be an illustrator. She's intelligent. She's perceptive. She's in a job that's way below her abilities. And she's a bit insecure and she's got this thug of a boyfriend. And they don't really portray that in The Office. In The Office, Pam is the Pam character, the Dawn character, is unhappy in her situation, and that's hinted at. And he's unhappy, but he's not unhappy because he's a university dropout and he knows he's fucked up. And he doesn't live at home with his parents. He's got his own flat. And he gets bonuses and he kind of enjoys his job. Whereas the brilliance of The Office was an understanding that you get these different kinds of people that do that kind of job, that office job, which I did myself as my first.
But it's back
job.
To Darren's point about it's the humour at the heart of tragedy.
Yeah.
And I think that is a uniquely, not uniquely British, but it's what the Americans do not get about Britain. We laugh at tragedy.
Yeah.
And the Americans have this pathological need to have happy scenarios.
Oh, God, they had a bit in it in one of the episodes where they all sing a song to cheer up the David Brent character. I think his name is Michael Scott. They all get together and sing a song about how great it is working for him and how happy they all are and how wonderful it is. It's totally different from the original.
Well, the worst ever example of this was there was a Dutch-French collaboration, this film called The Vanishing, that's about a serial killer who buries people. And in the American version, Kiefer Sutherland rescues the woman who's been buried. And it's like comedy. It's like a Benny Hill. The denouement of the film is like a Benny Hill video. It's
the
that
original
level.
Ends. Yeah, the original, the Dutch version, how that ends is a very dark ending.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just leaves with this... this unease, but the American version, they overcome the evil, they win, they triumph, they save the day, that sort of thing. It's a very different version. Just like you were mentioned in The Office, I mean, David Brent is a very tragic character. He's delusional, and he believes himself to be so popular. He thinks he's talented. He thinks he's worth more, and because he's in this documentary, he thinks he's now set for stardom and so on. The American version. You have someone who, the Michael Scott character, the best way I can describe him, he's just like a man-child, really. Very over-enthusiastic and impulsive and so on, but he's more of a man-child.
It does make me think it's why America is a bit like, we are, the UK is like Greece to Rome. The Americans have the technology, the power, and there's lots and lots of admirable things about America. But understanding that notion of tragedy, and being able to appreciate that cultural level of humor. Don't get me wrong, there are certain Americans who've got an amazingly sarcastic sense of humor. But on average, Americans lack that sarcastic insight, which is...
The most terrible example of this to me was I was about 9 or 10, maybe I was 10, and one of my favorite Roald Dahl books was The Witches. And I'd read it many times. And I was really looking forward to the fact that there was going to be a film of The Witches, and Rowan Atkinson was in it, and I liked Mr. Bean, and Angelica Houston was in it. She was the chief witch, and blah, blah, blah. And in the film version, they inserted, like, this turncoat witch that becomes a good witch at the end, right? And then at the end of The Witches, the boy who in The Witches, who is kind of the eye of the story, is turned into a mouse, and he remains a mouse forever, like until he dies. A mouse, a talking mouse, but a mouse. But in the film, there's this twist at the end where this good witch suddenly turns him back into a boy. And he'd be very, very angry.
But again, back to be serious for a second, it's a bit like Watership Down. It's kids aren't exposed to that level of educational misery.
Right, they need to know.
And then psychological resilience needs exposure to that level of sadness. And if you're never exposed to it, how do you ever build up the resilience?
And you don't. And
Andrew Doyle pointed out one time when he was talking about safety culture and so on, he had said that the old man in the sea was now coming with a trigger warning. The trigger warning is, this book contains scenes of graphic fishing.
I was watching this thing about Virginia Giuffre on Newsnight the other day, and there was a trigger warning. You know, this report contains discussions of Prince Andrew and Virginia Giuffre, essentially. I mean, what's the point of giving a trigger warning? You know what it's about. And we used to have it that there was, I remember when it, in Finland, when it was Baklan massacre in 2003. This is Finland, and so Finland's always behind the times. and they just put on TV like the naked, unblurred corpses of children, and nobody thought anything of that, and there was no trigger warning. It was just, yeah, it's life. So
maybe there's a happy medium though, Ed. I wouldn't want to be as miserable as the bloody Finns, but I wouldn't want to be as stupidly optimistic as North Americans.
So maybe the Irish?
Some will at least Americans have Curb Your Enthusiasm, the best show on TV.
That's another one I keep getting recommended, Lipton. And I've never seen an episode.
Oh, you've got to watch that, Darren.
It's supposed to be hilarious, and I've never seen
it. I'm like Larry David.
Lipton, at the risk of setting off all the anti-Semites in the comment section, I would argue that there is an important aspect of Curb Your Enthusiasm is the tradition of Jewish dark humor. So it's not really typically American from that point of view.
I watched the best film ever on the aeroplane from Heathrow to Helsinki the other day. And it was called Inside Out 2. Oh, it's fantastic. It was. It was way... Basically, Inside Out 1 is kind of a plagiarism of that Beza thing. What was it called in the Beza? Where it's this bloke and there's these things...
Numbskulls.
The numbskulls, exactly.
The numbskulls,
yeah. They basically just stole that idea. And then Inside Out 2, the character becomes a teenager and they introduce all these new emotions. And, it's brilliant. It is. I was moved. So everyone go and watch Inside Out 2. Now I'm going to have to wind up. So I'd like to thank Darren for coming on. It's very interesting and a very interesting discussion. And so go and read that the old Virginia Roberts book, chaps. It's very interesting. We will see you all soon. And I think Lipton's been a very good boy this week. So I'm gonna leave this up. Goodbye.
Goodbye.